The North Carolina Reading Service intends the following program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. And that program is Indie Week. This is The Independent, and I'm John Feddersen to read this week's issue, dated April the 9th of 2026. Well, we have a state Supreme Court reversing their ruling on the Leandro School Funding Plan. That ruling came out in 2022, and it ended a marathon legal battle over public school funding with this ruling on Thursday that tossed out a judge's order that would have forced lawmakers to spend billions of dollars on public education. Chief Justice Paul Newby wrote in the 4-3 majority opinion that brings a close to the long-running Leandro case. Republican Justice Richard Dietz and Democratic Justices Allison Riggs and Anita Earls dissented. The lawsuit, which took on many iterations over the past three decades, became a test of the division of power between the three branches of state government in recent years. Newby wrote, "As this litigation comes to a close, a few weeks shy of its 32nd anniversary, we are reminded of these principles from our prior cases. In our Constitution, the people established a tripartite system of government." Newby wrote, "In doing so, the people did not vest the judicial branch with the power to resolve policy disputes between the other branches of government or to set education policy. We would be especially ill-equipped to resolve such questions in any event." Leandro v. North Carolina began in 1994 when five low-wealth counties sued the state over what they contended was inadequate funding. That case has been in and out of court ever since, as the state grappled with how to ensure a fair education for students in both wealthier and poorer districts. The central question in the most recent round of court battles has been, can the courts order the legislature to spend $5.5 billion on an 8-year plan that lawmakers did not develop or sign off on to improve educational opportunities for the more than 1.5 million children in pre-kindergarten through 12th grade? Newby, who penned the majority's opinion, wrote, "The judicial branch is not the venue in which to seek education policy reform, but ultimately dismissed the lawsuit based on procedural grounds. The question of whether the courts could order education spending in other situations was left unresolved." Their ruling came 770 days after a controversial rehearing of that landmark case. Education advocates have gathered at rallies, pushed for legislative meetings, and held press briefings to highlight the costs of waiting for what they had hoped would be the funding that the court had ordered. Public school districts, meanwhile, faced difficult decisions about closing schools due to declining enrollment, which resulted in drops in state funding. A growing chunk of state money in recent years went towards vouchers, subsidizing private school tuition. Democratic Governor Josh Stein was quick to respond to the Thursday ruling, saying it does not change the state's fundamental responsibility to its students. He said in a statement, "Education opens doors of opportunity for children, but today the court slammed them in the face of students who deserve the right to a sound basic public education. The Supreme Court simply ignored its own established precedent, enabling the General Assembly to continue to deprive another generation of North Carolina students of the education promised by our Constitution." Stein said the General Assembly's investment in public school education in recent years puts North Carolina close to the bottom of the country in terms of per-pupil spending, saying four Supreme Court justices believe that's okay, but they are wrong. Their decision is contrary to the plain language of our Constitution and the court's past rulings. Earls wrote in her dissent, which Riggs signed on to, that the majority betrayed the state constitution's guarantee that every child will receive a sound basic education. Earls wrote, the majority concludes it will not order the state to correct the way it has harmed public school students, even in very low-wealth school districts like Hoke County, and even as two previous courts concluded the state is failing to adequately educate students and must act to fix the public education system. Tamika Kelly, president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, called the court's decision a moral failure. Quote, no state does less for its public schools in North Carolina. That fact was cemented today by our highest court. The Cumberland County Board of Education also said it was disappointed with the outcome and would continue to advocate for more funding for low-wealth school districts. State Senate Leader Phil Berger said in a statement, quote, liberal education special interests had tried to, quote, impose their policy preferences via judicial fiat. Today's decision confirms the proper pathway for policymaking is the legislative process. Berger's son, Phil Berger Jr., was one of the justices who voted to overturn that 2022 ruling. Rob, this is back to basics. Rob Leandro, whose name has become synonymous with this decades-long fight, was an eighth grader when the lawsuit started. He's now a lawyer in Raleigh with Parker Poe, the firm that has represented his old district and four others in Cumberland, Halifax, Robeson, and Vance counties. In 1997, the state Supreme Court found that all North Carolina students are entitled to a, quote, sound basic education, unquote. And that ruling allowed the lawsuit, arguing that the state wasn't providing that in poorer areas, to proceed to trial. 5 years later, Wake County Superior Court Judge Howard Manning ruled the state had fallen down on its sound basic education obligation and ordered that every school have a well-trained principal and a certified teacher in every classroom. Manning's ruling focused on Hoke County, and the state Supreme Court later ordered the lower court to gather more evidence from all the districts. Manning oversaw that case for years, primarily focusing on classroom instruction and not on funding issues. Manning's successor, Judge W. David Lee, was assigned to that case in 2016 and later approved a settlement agreement that called for the state to spend billions over 8 years. But the Republican-led legislature objected, setting the stage for this judicial debate that dragged on until Thursday. In 2022, when there were four Democratic justices on the state Supreme Court and three Republicans, the majority issued a ruling that said the courts could order lawmakers to fund the plan. That ruling came just before the elections, judicial elections, that flipped that partisan makeup into a Republican majority. Shortly after the new justices took office, the court agreed to revisit three high-profile political cases, one about gerrymandering, another about voter ID, and Leandro. Decisions to rehear a case are typically very rare. The court had granted only two petitions for rehearing since 1993. One of the attorneys in the Leandro case called the decision to grant a new hearing, quote, one of the most astounding, egregious acts that I have ever witnessed, unquote. The justices heard arguments in 2024. In the decision issued Thursday, the majority voted to dismiss the case with prejudice, meaning the same plaintiffs could not bring it again. But that would not stop other litigants from bringing new lawsuits with similar complaints of inadequate school funding. Dietz wrote in his Thursday dissent that unlike the majority, he saw a path forward, quote, that cures the state's shameful failure to meet its constitutional obligations, unquote, while also returning public education policy to the other branches of government. The Republican justice disagreed with permanently dismissing the case, as the majority had ordered. Dietz said he would have sent the case back to the trial court, brought lawmakers into the negotiations and included more school voices. Quote, I can only speculate about why this court felt so compelled to rush Leandro to the finish line by the end of 2022. Whatever the reason, no Leandro decision will stand the test of time unless it is obtained through a process of inclusion, not exclusion. At least one other justice expects more litigation. Berger wrote in an opinion, before the ink is dry on this decision, countless lawsuits over education policy and funding will be filed across North Carolina. He wanted the opinion written by the Chief Justice to explicitly disavow the majority's reasoning in that 22 Supreme Court opinion, known by the shorthand Hoke 3. Berger wrote, half measures will only ensure that we will be back here again with profiteering lawyers and constitutional evolutionists who fetishize a government of judges, by the judges, and for judges, who can legitimately argue that the reasoning of Hoke 3 remains. For separation of powers stalwarts, this is a demoralizing head-scratcher. Well, who will succeed Greg Meyer in the North Carolina Senate? Jonah Garson, State Democratic Party Vice Chair. Garson will succeed Meyer to represent Orange, Caswell, and Person counties in the State Senate. He will also replace Meyer on the November ballot in the safe blue district, so he is all but set to hold that seat until 2028. State law sets Garson up to be officially seated before the week ends. He was selected over the weekend by a committee of six local Democratic Party officials, two from each of the three counties. Five of those committee members voted for Garson, and one from Person County opted for State Representative Alan Buonsi. State Representative Renee Price and Kenneth Perry, who serves on several local government boards in Person, did not receive any votes from that committee. Garson said in a press release, I look forward to working with Senate Minority Leader Sidney Batch and alongside Representatives Buonsi, Jefferson, Price to win the progressive policies our communities need. Meyer served two terms in the state Senate before resigning to serve as executive director of the Justice Center. He previously served four terms in the state House. When Meyer announced his resignation, Garson moved aggressively to lock down endorsements from many local Democratic notables and flood his website and social media with that evidence. The appointment, he previously told Indy, is, quote, about fielding the best team of complementary strengths, experiences, and maintaining seniority where we can for that collective progressive strength, which means keeping Buonsi and Price where they are in the House. He said last week, I have deep relationships across all three of these counties. I know these counties, and I know rural North Carolina well from organizing all across the state. When our local jurisdictions are trying to do the best with the resources they have, we just have to have a legislator who brings in an organizer's orientation, perspective, and experience. Garson's candidacy also drew some detractors. As Indy reported last week, three Senate Democrats and two other officials said they feared Garson would create instability in Raleigh at a time when the caucus needs to be united. But it seems Garson was at least able to unify most of the committee. Bonnie Bevan, a committee member representing Orange County who voted for him, wrote to Indy to call him a rule follower and to call the story vindictive. Prior to the appointment, committee member Kenneth Woods, who ultimately voted for Garson, told Indy, whoever doesn't win, they simply need to accept the decision and just move forward, unquote, and local politicos are sure to keep an eye on if Senator-designate Garson and his colleagues can play nice in Raleigh. Over to Cary now, the town manager fallout and the budget process. This is titled After Town Manager Fallout. Cary aims for, quote, the most robust budget process we've ever had. after the town manager resigned last fall amid allegations of financial mismanagement, among other things. The town's remaining leaders pledged a series of reforms, including a more transparent budget process. Mayor Harold Weinberg announced this in February in his State of Kerry address. Quote, "This budget process will probably be the most robust we've ever had." More broadly, he pledged that Kerry would come out on the other side of the town manager debacle as a national model for government accountability. Quote, "We'll probably have the strongest guardrails of anybody." Unquote. Town leaders commissioned an independent investigation into the former town manager's activities and submitted to scrutiny from the state auditor and the Wake County District Attorney's Office. They set about responding to an 80-plus to 80-plus public records request. And most recently, they debuted a new kind of event, a budget open house, to explain the municipal budget to residents and to gather their input. There are some non-negotiables in the town's roughly $500 million budget, like paying the staff of 1,200 and funding essential departments. But there are also plenty of choices to make. Investments in parks, greenways, staff pay raises, affordable housing, or public safety reflect the town's values. On Tuesday, I went to the budget open house, writes this author, to find out what the fuss was about. Inside this Kerry Senior Center, a phalanx of town staffers had set up booths with posters and handouts breaking down what each department does. Weinbrecht was there, along with several town council members, and here are some takeaways from Kerry's budget open house. Anecdotally, people still trust the town of Kerry with their tax dollars. Several attendees told Indy they don't hold the former town manager's alleged financial misconduct to the tune of over $1 million against the town. Patrick Murray, resident who volunteers on the Kerry's Information Service Advisory Board, said, "It doesn't change my trust because I think the town is bigger than one person." A resident in Randy said, "I give them a world of credit. There wasn't some cover-up. They were very upfront about it." Next, residents named high-quality town services as their top budget priority. During this open house, residents were asked to fill out a survey ranking a list of priorities, including affordability, community safety, environmental stewardship, fiscal responsibility, high-performing staff, maintaining service levels, and new capital investment. Most of the attendees I talked to named maintaining service levels as their top priority, and they said they would willingly pay more taxes or support more dense development if that's what it takes to fund seamless trash pickup, 311 service, greenway maintenance, and more. Now, the official results of that survey are not available yet. Town council members did a similar ranking exercise at their annual retreat last February and chose community safety as their top budget priority, followed by new capital investment, investing in staff and affordability. Pressure still exists to raise taxes. Kerry's property tax rate is currently the lowest of any Wake County municipality at 34 cents per $100 of assessed value. The town is able to set the rate so low in part because property values are relatively high compared to other Wake municipalities. This is especially true post-2024, when a property revaluation raised the assessed value of all residential property from $21.5 billion to $33.4 billion. That's an increase of 55%. Last year, the Kerry Town Council unanimously voted to raise property taxes by 1.5 cents per $100 valuation. Town staff explained at the time the bump was necessary to accommodate inflation, offset plateauing growth in population, and fund updates to aging infrastructure. Those same forces are still at play this year. During the budget open house, Assistant Town Manager Donna Widmar gave a presentation explaining that budgets require trade-offs. If you want a community with low density and stable service levels, expect a tax increase. If you want a lower tax rate, you have to cut services or allow for more dense development. Councilmember Michelle Craig put it even more simply. You either raise taxes or you take something away. Kerry resident Narenga Agarwal told Indy, for me, I'm happy to pay for better service levels. Other residents may still be reeling from the sticker shock of that revaluation, but Widmar said Agarwal's sentiment is consistent with what she's heard from many other residents. It depends on the individual, she said, but most Kerry people live in Kerry because they like the service level and the community we live in. They'd like to be able to maintain what they are used to. Next article from Durham, released just today, April 9th, concerns Duke bought a duplex that housed a thriving community space. Within months, it was gone. Was that a coincidence? When you're a kid, there's something about a vacant space that announces itself as a clubhouse. It couldn't be more apparent that the shed in the backyard needs a rug and password and a sign on the door. Most people lose that impulse somewhere along the way. Kelly Creedon never did. A few years after the now 48-year-old moved into the left half of a duplex at 407 Swift Avenue in Durham, the right unit went vacant, and Creedon proposed converting it into a community gathering space that she could subsidize by booking it on Airbnb 1 week a month. Her landlord agreed, and over the next 6 years, the space grew to become the living room, a wholesome hub for plant swaps, potlucks, and activist meetups that ran on the scrappy goodwill of a little free library. On a given evening, you might have walked up to the duplex to find a comedy troupe mid-rehearsal, or a yoga class stretching under string lights, or 15 people learning to build a trellis in the side yard while someone inside led a writing workshop. View projects even got their start at the living room, like a monthly song circle called the Durham Ceasefire Chorus, and a community garden that in summertime grew thick with radishes, tomatoes, okra, beans, peppers, and mini watermelons. By last year, the space was hosting gatherings nearly every other day, and Creedon and other organizers had started thinking bigger, exploring grants, sketching out an infrastructure with other grassroots spaces around Durham. Then in September, Creedon got a text from her landlord, Kanu Dibona. Duke University was interested in buying 407 Swift Avenue, wrote Dibona. Officials would be coming for a walk-through the following week. Creedon's stomach dropped. She'd long been aware that Duke had its sights on that property, which sits amid swaths of Duke-owned land on the edge of the central campus. But Dibona had always told her he wasn't interested in selling to Duke, so his text carried with it the particular sting of news you've taught yourself not to worry about. Creedon texted back to ask Dibona would consider selling to her. It wasn't an idle question. She'd expressed interest in buying that multiple times during her 10 years as a tenant, and the two had a record of easy collaboration. When Creedon asked to switch to a month-to-month lease, she felt afforded her more flexibility. For instance, Dibona obliged. This time was different. After years of Duke pressing him to sell, Dibona had finally said yes, and Duke had come back with an offer Dibona told Creedon he didn't think she could match. He did not, by the way, respond to multiple requests for comment. Duke's visit the next week made it clear the sale was well underway, and officials arrived with a home inspector and property management. The deal closed on the 31st of October, Duke paying $575,000 for the property, which in the spring had been valued at close to $526,000 by tax assessors. There's nothing unusual about Duke buying a property in its backyard, its central campus, a long triangle of land with vertices at Duke's medical campus, the Nasher Museum of Art, and a small residential pocket off Swift Avenue, is the product of a land banking strategy that has, over decades, swallowed much of the surrounding neighborhoods. But at a moment when Duke was particularly invested in its image as a good neighbor to Durham, the way the university navigated its brief role as landlord to Creedon, and in turn the living room, feels incongruous with its stated commitments to community partnership. In late September, 2 weeks after the Duke contingent's first visit, Duke Director of Real Estate Julie Sigmund returned to 407 Swift to talk to Creedon about her options as a renter. She could keep renting if she wanted to, said Sigmund, but the duplex's roof, HVAC, and electrical panels were nearing the end of their useful lives, she said, citing an inspection report, and Duke, which has no specific plans for that block, but intends to someday redevelop, was not interested in making long-term investments in a 1919 build it did not intend to keep standing. Creedon, a documentary filmmaker, recorded that conversation. In North Carolina, only one party needs to consent to a recording. Sigmund offered Creedon a six-month lease at her existing monthly rate of $950, with an option to renew, but made clear the arrangement would, quote, kind of limp along until something broke that Duke was not willing to address. Sigmund said, I don't want to be in a situation where I have to give a tenant a 30-day notice to vacate. You don't want it from a planning perspective either. Creedon told Sigmund she hadn't been experiencing any issues. Sigmund agreed nothing major needed replacing immediately, but reiterated concerns about what could go wrong down the line, telling Creedon she didn't want to be a, quote, bad landlord. I don't want you to be dealing with a roof that can't be fixed and an owner that's not going to replace it. Creedon didn't feel that any of this added up to a real offer to stay. She signed that six-month lease, but only after ensuring it included a provision allowing early termination without penalty. As soon as she found new housing, she left, relocating to Northgate Park in February. She's paying about the same rent as she was on Swift Avenue, though she has a roommate now. In a statement to Indy, the Duke spokesperson emphasized Creedon had moved out voluntarily and said the six-month lease offered, quote, more security than the month-to-month deal she'd had with DeBona. The spokesperson also noted Duke had made repairs to keep the property, quote, safe and habitable for Creedon, referencing a handful of minor fixes. Creedon was, per city directories, the latest in an unbroken line of largely working-class renters at 407 Swift, stretching back more than a century. Machinists, textile workers, postal clerks, waitresses, painters, students. Her departure means one of Durham's increasingly scarce parcels of naturally occurring affordable housing has seen its last tenant. It also means the living room is gone. The space shut down in February when Creedon moved out. It was important to Creedon that Duke understood the living room's legitimacy as a community institution. When officials came for their initial visit, Creedon pointed them toward the fire pit, where community members gathered for song circles, and rooms where groups held workshops and retreats. The space had hosted more than 100 events so far that year. She told Sigmund, it's been a very collaborative model, and a lot of folks are invested. Sigmund was receptive to hearing about it, but she didn't indicate that the presence of a community space would change Duke's willingness to invest in the property. Creedon came away feeling deflated about Duke's math. They're talking about the frame of potential financial costs, she said, but they're not weighing that against the very real human and community costs of losing a community space. By all appearances, the living room simply had not factored into how Duke chose to handle the property, unless, of course, it had. In his 1989 book, The Great Good Place, the late sociologist Ray Oldenburg coined the term third places to describe informal gathering spots distinct from home and work where people go to decompress and find connection. Oldenburg stressed that third places are not merely an escape from the rat race, but something with their own positive gravity, quote, an essential element of the good life, where a community is most alive and people are most themselves. Based on criteria articulated by Oldenburg, few spaces have embodied that concept as fully as the living room did. Oldenburg, in his book, contended the best third places are shared almost entirely by the people who use them, a model that's difficult to achieve because most gathering spaces are businesses and bottom lines tend to limit what a space can become. And the living room pulled it off. Creedon and an early collaborator, Ligaya Romero, kept things intentionally vague when launching the space. They threw a housewarming, asked people to bring furnishings, and didn't prescribe much else. Over time, the space took form as a sliding scale venue that sometimes served as temporary housing for people in transition. Creedon managed event bookings and cleaned up after Airbnb guests, but with no incentive to turn a profit, the place required little else in the way of active management. The living room also captured what Oldenburg considered a paradox of the best third places. It had all the trappings of a home, a full kitchen, a fold-out couch, a big backyard, yet it was not anyone's actual home, sparing visitors what Oldenburg described as the inevitable feeling of intrusion that comes with entering someone else's space. That ease showed in the range of things people felt comfortable doing there. Spanish-English interpreter trainings, a monthly Jewish kids meetup, a research resource share called Free Coffee for Free Palestine, performance art rehearsals, writing groups, film screenings, and book packing for incarcerated women, among dozens of other activities. Oldenburg ascribe two more qualities to third places that resonate with what went on at living room. He wrote, they nurture a kind of amateurism, compelling visitors to discover personal capacities that the rigid social roles of everyday life tend to bury. And he considered them political fora of great importance, where people realize a collective power essential to democracy. The Durham Ceasefire Chorus, one of the projects the living room truly incubated, bore both of these traits out. Most of its members were not trained musicians. Rather, they were people who discovered through the act of sitting in a circle and singing together that music could be both a salve and a form of resistance. Jess Dickerson came across an Instagram post about this chorus in 2024 and showed up to what turned out to be the group's very first meetup. Dickerson told Indy, I never thought there was a place for my music, but I realized there is a place for it here. Dickerson fell into rhythm of the chorus's regular gatherings, and they found something deeper when the chorus carried that music out into the world, singing at demonstrations for Palestine liberation and other causes. Last year, Dickinson ruptured their Achilles tendon and encountered another phenomenon Oldenburg attributes to third places, mutual aid. For 3 months, Ceasefire Chorus members showed up at Dickerson's door with meals, cleaned their house, and sang to them. Dickerson said it was just this next level form of community. Even in 1989, Oldenburg warned that third places were vanishing on a large scale for a few reasons. They tend to occupy old buildings, which makes them perpetually vulnerable to redevelopment, and their natural role as political gathering places has a way of putting them at odds with powerful institutions. Within a few hundred feet of 407 Swift, Duke owns three other century-old houses, all of which currently have tenants in them. One Duke has owned since 1997, and the other two it acquired within the past 2 years. During one of her September visits, Sigmund offered to check whether any were available for Creedon. They weren't. It's hard to know what condition those houses were in when Duke bought them, relative to 407 Swift. Sigmund described them as being in better shape than the duplex, but indicated that was at least partly a result of investments Duke had made, including replacing HVAC units and installing a new roof. A tenant living in one of those houses Duke purchased within the last 2 years told Indy in March he'd been there about 6 months and was not aware Duke owned the property. He'd only dealt with a third-party management company. He described the house as old, with water spots on the ceiling, but said he'd had no trouble getting repairs done. Aerial imagery suggests that repairs were made to the roof of that house in the fall 2024, a few months after Duke bought it. Roof repairs were something Sigmund adamantly told Creedon that Duke would not be willing to make at 407 Swift, speculating during one visit that Creedon could end up with, quote, pots and pans holding up the roof. Was 407 Swift in that much worse shape than this other property? A Duke spokesperson told Indy, quote, every property has its own maintenance challenges, and whenever Duke invests in real estate, we work cooperatively and in good faith with any tenants. Several noted critics of Duke's land use practices speculated whether dimensions beyond the condition of the duplex could have influenced the university's approach to 407 Swift. For one, Durham City Council member Nate Baker, noting the Duke's duplex's prominently placed Free Palestine Yard sign and the political activities in the space. The living room was a space that especially elevated the voices of the oppressed, including the Palestinian struggle. Was that a motivation for Duke to shutter the living room? I don't know. It would not be out of character from what universities across the country have done to silence recent anti-genocide and anti-apartheid campaigns. A former Old West Durham neighborhood president, John Schlepp, who'd spent 3 years negotiating land use agreements with Duke, told Indy, Duke has three priorities. Number three is sports and academics. Number two is money. And number one is image. If there is a house that they just bought that is creating a headache, they will protect their image first and foremost. A Duke spokesperson told Indy, quote, any activity hosted in or near this space had no bearing on Duke's decision regarding the property, unquote. Whether or not politics played a role, Oldenburg might argue there's a kind of accountability either way. The democratic cost of losing a third place is the same, whether or not anyone set out to cause it. Is the result any less negative without the intent? He wrote. The closure of the living room comes at a conspicuous moment for Duke. At once one of Durham's largest landowners and exempt from property taxes on most of its holding, the university has faced sustained pressure in recent years to contribute more directly to city and county tax bases, while private universities are legally entitled to tax exemption on academic properties. Critics argue that Duke's stature makes it a poor fit for the standard carve-out. Its $12 billion endowment puts it amongst the wealthiest universities in the country, and Durham, where affordability is a growing crisis, is straining under the lost revenue, critics say. The Duke Respect Durham Coalition thinks Duke should cough up as much as $50 million a year to make up for the foregone tax revenue. There is some precedent for such payment in lieu of taxes, albeit smaller ones, at peer institutions like Yale, Brown, and Cornell. Duke has responded in part with a messaging blitz touting its existing contributions to Durham. In the fall, its Duke for Durham campaign, splashed on yard signs, Facebook ads, and fact sheets, highlighted its employee benefits, the infrastructure it maintains at its own expense, and the property taxes it pays on non-academic properties, like the land it has banked in the central campus area. And the university has also opened its wallet. Duke last month announced Homegrown, a $200 million initiative that over the next 3 years aims to direct more spending into the Triangle, including $38 million in deposits with financial institutions that fund affordable housing. But groups like Duke Respect Durham say philanthropy is not a real proxy for contributing to the tax base. As long as Duke controls when and how it gives back, the university's relationship with Durham remains lopsided, these critics argue. The debate takes on added weight given the history of Duke's growth. Roughly 450 houses once stood on the land that now accommodates Duke's central campus and parts of Highway 147, home to workers at the nearby long-since-defunct Irwin Cotton Mills. The houses formed a string of communities from the white working-class West Durham to the historically black Brookstown and Hickstown. Most were destroyed in two waves. Schlepp, who has been so long immersed in the history of the mill village that he has an Irwin Mills-themed bathroom, traces both to Duke. In the mid-60s, the university purchased the former Irwin Cotton Mills property, including working houses, housing, and over the next decade cited minor defects to get the city to condemn the houses and tore down scores of them to build student apartments. Not long after, more houses were raised for construction of Highway 147, a project that then Duke President Terry Sanford supported, quote, without reservation, per a letter he wrote to a member of the State Transport Board. Today, granite curbs from the old Mill Village Lane, from the old Mill Village, line the paths around the lake at Duke Gardens. On Central Campus, stone steps still rise into vacant lots where houses used to stand. Much of Central Campus fields emptied out. The student housing Duke built atop the Mill Village land was torn down in 2019. A handful of institutional buildings dot the area, like the Freeman Center for Jewish Life, an international enrollment office, along with a block of luxury student apartments and surface parking lots. But the prevailing impression is of space waiting to be filled. Duke plans to overhaul the area eventually, but has offered few details. When the university appeared before Durham City Council in 2024 seeking to rezone 10 parcels, it brought no development plans, just a request for broad latitude to build without further approval, and the council approved that rezoning by a vote of 5-2. During one of her visits to 407 Smith, Sigmund told Creedon her job is to, quote, buy opportunities. Duke told Indy it's still assessing its plans for the property. In February, the living room hosted its final event, a closing ceremony. It played out as a kind of inversion of the housewarming party that had launched the space 6 years prior. Back then, people had scribbled ideas for what the place could become on butcher paper tacked to the walls. Now, they sharpied goodbyes straight onto the wall itself. All the furnishings that were donated at the housewarming were laid out by the door for people to take. Attendees eventually ended up in the backyard in folding chairs around the fire pit. The community garden fanned out beside them, dormant for the winter, save for some carrots and greens. That garden sits on land that Duke has owned all along. Dubona negotiated permission for Creedon to use it back in 2020, and over the years, it grew into a bustling operation with weekly workdays and workshops on native plants. Over the past two seasons, it drew 150 volunteers and produced over 750 pounds of produce, some of which helped stock community fridges around Durham. This is the one tangible outgrowth of the living room that Creedon and other organizers are fighting to keep alive. They decided against trying to relocate the space itself. Finding an affordable equivalent is not realistic. But the garden, they believe, has a shot at surviving where it is. They're in talks with Duke about how to do so. It won't be simple. The duplex is being scheduled for demolition per a recent communication between Creedon and Sigmund, and once it's torn down, there will be no water hookup and nowhere to volunteers to use the bathroom. But both parties seem cautiously optimistic there is a way to make it work. Duke told the Indy it wants to enable the garden, quote, to continue for the foreseeable future, while also meeting our obligations to maintain the safety and accessibility of the property, unquote. Among the garden's earliest volunteers was Jaden Ward, who started showing up for work days when the garden was still just a couple of beds. They liked that they didn't need to bring any expertise or be on time. Ward said the thing about the living room was that it could hold whatever you brought to it. After their mother died unexpectedly of cancer in 2023, they held her funeral in the space, hanging fabric from the ceiling to the floor to create a kind of womb. Ward saying, I can't imagine having that service anywhere else. At the closing ceremony, Ward and a friend guided attendees in a grieving exercise around the fire pit to mourn the space itself. Rub your hands together, they said, and visualize the ball of energy the space has given you. The group spent the following hours sharing memories. It was frigid, but as the afternoon wore on, no one left. Instead, they drew closer and closer to the fire until more than half were sitting in a tight circle on the ground, shoulders pressed together against the cold. I have neglected to mention the author of my previous stories, and this one I think I've mentioned was Lena Geller, one of the regulars and a specialist in the Durham area, among others. Well written. Well, this next article also put in the Indie Week online today. It's authored by Sarah Edwards, another long-term author for Indy. And it's titled, At a Rocky Time, Local Arts Institutions Reckon with America's Birthday. Gas prices are up, so is the cost of housing, utilities, education, health care, and, with the exception of a carton of eggs, food. The United States has entered a war with Iran, and nobody seems to know why. Meanwhile, the year draws closer to a significant milestone, 250 years since the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. Since 2016, a congressional committee has been planning for the occasion through the initiative America 250. It's a natural time for introspection. The Trump administration, though, has made clear the expectation through executive orders like the Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, that target institutions, including the Smithsonian, that a certain kind of history be told in a certain kind of way. The America 250 website features calls for celebration and civic involvement, alongside AI photos of Americans with unnervingly perfect teeth, and a list of prominently placed sponsors that include BP, Amazon, and Lockheed Martin. This all makes it thorny for cultural institutions navigating how to engage with a significant historical event when education about history itself has become politicized. In the Triangle, two upcoming concerts are using the anniversary to bring together multidisciplinary North Carolina artists for musical reflections that contend with the American experiment and how we have or have not lived up to its ideals. Next month, on May 6th, the Durham Symphony Orchestra, DSO, commemorates America's founding alongside its own 50th anniversary with the season closer Letters to America. That concert will feature two new compositions, a world premiere by DSO maestro William Henry Curry, and North Carolina composer Brittany Murray's piece Letters to America, which was co-commissioned by that orchestra and recently saw its world premiere at Carnegie Hall. More immediately, this weekend, Raleigh's Martin Marietta Center for the Performing Arts actor Mike Wiley will give a live reading of the Declaration of Independence. The event coming up on April the 10th, about the day this you'll first hear this broadcast, Well, I Declare, America at 250. That's an installation in Pinecone's Down Home Concert Series and will feature musical responses to the document from Dawn Lands, Reese Palmer, Jacob Sharp, Mipso, and Django Haskins. Lenz, who lives in Chapel Hill, put together the musical component of that program, which features a mix of traditional and original songs, revisiting the Declaration, a document with, quote, punk rock sensibility that most people haven't read since childhood, she said, felt timely, especially in light of No King's Rally. She said, the Declaration is a list of complaints about the monarchy. We don't want a king. We don't want one person deciding what we can do without representation. And we want a democracy. People often expect that document to be, quote, more antiquated than it actually is. Alongside the Declaration, Wiley's portion of the event, said Lanz, is textured with the voices of people who were left out of this document. Women. Anyone of color. We hear Frederick Douglass. We hear some Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Both Lanz and Wiley do ongoing work based on history. Lanz released The Liberated Woman's Songbook in 2023, an album that draws on a rich catalog of folk songs related to women's activism. Wiley's, meanwhile, has made a career of staging educational documentary dramas that bring to life figures like Emmett Till, Booker T. Spicely, and Jackie Robinson. Wiley said, the right to protest is what this country was built on. It gained its freedom through that right. The document itself is the very symbol of protest. You know, some folks see it as a Dear John letter to the King and Parliament of England, but it's so much more than a Dear John letter. It is the rock of protest. David Brower, executive director at Pinecone, said he hopes the event can, quote, dig down and get to shared values that we've been working our way through for the past 250 years as a culture. The North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources echoes a nuanced approach on its website with a call to examine how, quote, the founding ideas were lived out, challenged, and reimagined by the people of North Carolina, unquote. Its website features an extensive calendar of events and exhibits around the state through July. For Durham Symphony Orchestra Vice President Jesse Rosen, the Letters to America concert reflects the orchestra's shift toward becoming increasingly community-centered. Rosen said, it's been that way from the beginning, but I think becoming more involved with issues of civic importance is something we're really interested in. There's a lot of room to play great music really well and do work that resonates and connects with things that matter to people in Durham. Last year, the symphony held a moving program centered on the deaths of unarmed black men by police. This year, in conjunction with the May 6th concert, it's an open call for letters that, quote, capture the varied experiences of black womanhood, with two letter-writing workshops hosted by North Carolina Poet Laureate Jackie Shelton Green. With this, the event looks at the past, but also at our shared present, and how it might look if black women specifically had had their voices heard and valued from the beginning. And finally, Shelton Green writes in a guide, a letter writing guide, I've been calling in more than just reflections, but also asking America, if she were starting from scratch today, what would she build? What would she stand for? What would she include? I started reflecting on how America has broken my heart, but also where I can still see the light. I reflected on what I still have hope for and what I'm willing to give. My last two articles in this week's Indie Week, I will have to forego. I'll read you the titles and just remind everyone, Indie Week is a free publication on the internet, indieweek.com. You can read all these stories and many, many, many more, including some ones that I've never had a chance to read, dining, restaurants, entertainment, etc. And the one here is called It's a Sisterhood Act, and it's about sistering is an anchor for women support beams, and this is a group of women musicians, four women on stage, a most unconventional chorus it's called, and that's all I have time to read about that. Sorry for fumbling the text. I can't summarize it. It's a sisterhood act. It's a musical review of sorts. Finally, an article about the Fluid Community Garage. This is going to open in Durham, which is a sort of alternate lifestyle garage featuring instruction and borrowable tools and space to work on cars, as well as get your car fixed. And it's LGBTQ friendly, and it's you can find that on Indie Week's website. A soon to open Durham garage, community is the driving force. All right, folks, this broadcast will occur on Friday, April the 10th. And then after that, it will go into the podcast bin for Independent or Indie Week. So I'm John Feddersen saying so long now from the Raleigh, North Carolina Reading Service from Indie Week. Bye-bye.